Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ellen Vollinger with the group Food Research and Action Center, who assesses the efforts in Congress to make deep cuts to the nation's food stamp program and the consequences for poor and struggling families. Rabbi Rachel Kahn Troster of the group Rabbis for Human Rights, who discusses new congressional attention on the damaging effects of prolonged solitary confinement of inmates in the U.S. prison system. And former FBI Special Agent and Whistleblower Colleen Raleigh, who considers WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's decision to request political asylum from Ecuador. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Pentagon's Africa Command is looking to expand its network into more hotspots for their anti-terrorist campaigns. A key base is in Ouagadougou, the capital city of Burkina Faso in West Africa, one of the poorest nations on the planet. From that base, the Washington Post reports, small turboprop planes fly over Mali, Mauritania, and the Sahara in search of al-Qaeda fighters. The secret flights took on a greater significance after a March coup in Mali that allowed al-Qaeda supporters to set up an independent Islamic state in northern Mali. In central and eastern Africa, covert flights have tracked the militant Islamic group Boko Haram in Nigeria, which has launched deadly attacks against United Nations facilities and Nigeria's Christian community. In Somalia, U.S. forces are backing a regional offensive against the Islamic group Al-Shabaab, an affiliate of al-Qaeda. In Uganda, spy flights aid 100 American Special Forces troops, assisting the local military in tracking down rebel leader Joseph Kony, wanted for human rights abuses, including the use of child soldiers. The U.S. Africa Command has plans to expand its presence in the newly independent nation of South Sudan, where a simmering conflict threatens to erupt into full-scale war over control of the region's abundant supply of crude oil exported to both China and Japan. According to the Christian Science Monitor, crumbling water and sanitation systems in Lagos, Nigeria, are blamed for that nation's high infant mortality rate from cholera and other deadly diseases. In Africa's most populous country, over 33 million people lack access to basic sanitation despite Nigeria's vast oil wealth. Improper disposal of human waste is blamed for high rates of childhood diarrhea and other illnesses caused by contaminated food and water. To address the sanitation crisis plaguing millions of people in the developing world, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation launched a campaign to design a 21st century toilet that is affordable to the poor and does not rely on running water or septic connections. Frank Riesberman, head of the Gates Foundation program on water sanitation and hygiene, recently told the 2012 Global Water Summit, "We need the cell phone of sanitation, an aspirational product." The Gates Foundation has an ambitious goal of assisting over 30 million people to gain access to community sanitation systems over the next 3 years. In New York State, where a conservative state senate adopted a gay marriage bill last June, the state's largest gay rights organization recently fired its director for failing to meet fundraising targets and not articulating a new vision. Like the civil rights and feminist movements, gay rights activists are beginning to suffer from the so-called curse of victory syndrome, winning legal equality without fundamentally changing the culture and transforming an economic system that breeds poverty and intolerance. But broadening the focus of gay rights activist groups toward a more encompassing social justice agenda would challenge the power of a small number of big donors who fund most major gay rights organizations. Some activists observe that in recent years, these donors have narrowed the LGBT agenda into a single-issue movement. Longtime gay rights activist Irvishai Vade of Columbia Law School's Center for Gender and Security Law observes that many gay activists have settled for individual equality instead of creating a public arena where, quote, queer sexuality is not only tolerated but celebrated. Vade argues it is time for the LGBT movement to embrace a new social justice vision, merging concerns about sexual and racial equality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As Congress debates the 1,000-page farm bill, Republicans have targeted the federal food stamp program for deep cuts, now known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Over the past 4 years of the Great Recession, the numbers of Americans receiving food stamps has increased from 28 million to 46 million, with a doubling of the cost. With stubbornly high unemployment and millions of people facing the exhaustion of their unemployment compensation checks, many middle-class families will be turning to help from the food stamp program for the first time in their lives. The U.S. Agriculture Department says that food stamp assistance helps keep 5 million Americans out of poverty. In order to be eligible to receive food stamps, a household must have a gross income below 130% of the federal poverty level. The Farm Bill, which passed in the U.S. Senate on June 21st, has $4.5 billion in cuts over 10 years that anti-hunger advocates say will harm large numbers of poor and struggling families. According to the Congressional Budget Office, an estimated 500,000 households a year will lose $90 per month in SNAP benefits. As the farm legislation moves to the GOP-controlled House of Representatives, conservative politicians who express little compassion for the nation's poorest and most vulnerable citizens are expected to demand deeper cuts in the food stamp program than already approved by the Democratic-led Senate. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Vollinger, food stamp and legal director with the group Food Research and Action Center. She assesses the efforts underway in Congress to make deep cuts to the nation's food stamp program and the consequences for poor and struggling families.
The Farm Bill is the legislative vehicle that every 5 years authorizes SNAP, formerly the food stamp program, and some other important programs. The nutrition title of that bill was the subject of action in the Senate this spring. And in the Senate, there was a vote to take out $4.5 billion out of SNAP benefits. Now, to put that in some context, that's a 10-year cut. The Congressional Budget Office believes that that will mean 500,000 needy households on SNAP across the country will lose, on average, $90 of SNAP benefits a month. We know that people who are on SNAP are low income. They have very little income. Many of them are not only below the poverty line, many of them are way below the poverty line, and they're struggling in a tough economy. We also know that the benefits they have, even before the cuts, are very, very modest. The average SNAP benefit is $4.35 a person a day. So I say that because a lot of times when you hear figures coming out of Washington, there are billions here and billions there, but we know from the Congressional Budget Office estimate that this may mean $90 a month for households on SNAP, 500,000 of those households on SNAP. So it's real money, real food money that's on the table at risk for needy families.
What does this mean in human terms? What will these families go through without that $90 coming in each month? What does that mean on the dinner plate?
Well, it means a lot. You know, your listeners are probably quite aware of how big a struggle it is for many families to be able to feed themselves. The maximum allotment on SNAP for a family of three is a little more than $500, about $526. So if that family were to lose $90, and some of them will lose more than that, some may lose a little less, you're likely talking about the last week of the month not having groceries to get through that. Many people across the country are already turning to food banks, to food pantries and soup kitchens to supplement these already low SNAP benefits. It'll just mean that the struggles will be even more acute. We don't know how the food banks and the food pantries and the soup kitchens that are already stretched are going to be able to meet that demand. So we're working very hard to try to educate Congress that this will mean greater struggles for people across the country, and we're hoping that they will rethink this cut and not make it.
I wanted to talk about the rising numbers of families in the country that are reliant on food stamps now to make ends meet. And I've read that the numbers of people on food stamps has risen over the past 4 years from 28 to 46 million participants.
And with more and more people reaching out for emergency benefits during these hard economic times, it seems really counterintuitive to be cutting these programs so deeply.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes that there are opponents of the programs who just want to look at the growth and don't want to examine what people are up against and why it is that they have to turn to the program. We sometimes hear, well, people don't want to work or they're not really in need. There are plenty of examples of people not being able to find jobs, and even when they find jobs, not having wages and benefits that are sufficient to really meet their family's needs. There's a statistic that the U.S. Labor Department puts out. It's called the U6 measure. That sounds, I think, like a lot of economic jargon to people, but in any event, it's called the U6 measure. What that does is give us a number of the people in the country, what percentage of the workforce is either unemployed or underemployed and maybe discouraged and given up looking. And it turns out that the percentage of people who are unemployed, underemployed, or discouraged, the percentage of the workforce, is very similar to the percentage of people, of residents, who are turning to SNAP. So it's both the unemployment that's going on, but even among people who are working, they're often working at wages and hours that just are not enough to feed their family. So to us, it's no surprise, either on an anecdotal basis or when we look at the data, including that labor force data, why it is the SNAP program is serving as many people as it is.
Ellen, just to close up here, you know, there's a lot of thinking that many people in the country oppose food stamps or oppose these social safety net programs, but you did a poll earlier this year that really contradicted that kind of common perception of the issues of welfare or social safety programs. Tell us about the poll, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would recommend that if people want to see the absolute details, they can come to our website, which is www.frac.org. Peter Hart Associates, which is a major polling firm in Washington, did the survey and found that 77% of the Americans surveyed would not want to see SNAP cut. And that was across the board. It was somewhat higher among Democrats, a little bit lower among Republicans, but I think even among Republicans, it was over 60% that didn't want to see SNAP cut. So one thing I think that it does underscore, and it's something we've seen over many decades in the United States, and that is that the American public does not want to see people going hungry, and that really is a shared value across party lines. It's something that is bipartisan, and we hope would remain so.
That was Ellen Volinger, food stamp and legal director with the group Food Research and Action Center. Find more news and analysis on attacks targeting the nation's social safety net programs on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, held a first-of-its-kind congressional hearing June 19th on the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, a practice many human rights advocates assert is torture. The hearing took testimony from prison officials, relatives of prisoners, and former inmates on the damaging effects of the practice. The hearing before the Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights followed the filing of a class-action federal lawsuit by the Center for Constitutional Rights May 31st on behalf of prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in California who have spent between 10 and 28 years in solitary confinement. Under solitary confinement, prisoners are held by themselves in small cells for up to 23 hours per day with 1 hour set aside for exercise. According to the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, studies have documented the detrimental psychological effects of solitary confinement, such as hallucinations, paranoia, and panic attacks. The United States leads the world in the number of prisoners held in prolonged solitary confinement, with at least 80,000 inmates subjected to the conditions on any given day. Rabbi Rachel Kahn Troster, who was at the hearing, is the director of North American programs for the group Rabbis for Human Rights North America and serves on the board of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rabbi Troster, who describes the significance of the hearing, how solitary confinement came to be seen as torture, and how congressional attention on the practice could help improve conditions for death row inmates and others.
It was a one-day hearing, and what was significant about it was the first time that the Senate had ever in any way looked at solitary confinement as an issue in American prisons. And it really felt like an exciting and a significant moment for the human rights community. The hearing room was packed. That really underscored how significant it was that the Senate decided to investigate the use of solitary confinement. I think a really significant highlight was hearing from Anthony Graves, who's a former death row prisoner from Texas. He was exonerated 2 years ago. He spent 18 years in solitary confinement in Texas because he was a prisoner on death row. Many death row prisoners are, by definition, in solitary confinement. And he was exonerated 2 years ago, and he's been released from prison. And he spoke about what it was like for him to be on death row and what it was like for him to be in solitary confinement and the ways it still affects him. He says that he still cries every night from the effects of his incarceration. He said he saw people go mad, people who weren't mentally ill before they were put in solitary confinement. People went nuts. He talked about, it was a very shocking moment, about one prisoner gouging out his own eye. I also thought it was really critical that we heard from Christopher Epps, who's the state commissioner of prisons in Mississippi, and he's the longest serving state prison commissioner in the country. And Mississippi is not a state that's known for being soft on crime, so the fact that he was able to speak about how he had reduced solitary confinement in Mississippi prisons, and he closed one of their supermax prisons, and how effective that had been in making the prison population safer. He spoke about the fact that many of the people in his prisons were mentally ill, and that what we needed was to deal with the mentally ill before they ended up in prison. To hear him say that was incredibly significant, and it highlights the fact that solitary confinement is not a left-right issue. It's a bipartisan issue, and different states with different political persuasions are beginning to take this on and understand that we as Americans have to reduce the use of solitary confinement for all kinds of reasons, whether it's cost, whether it's human rights, whether it's sheer efficacy in keeping prison guards safe, because violence is often reduced in prisons that reduce the use of solitary confinement. We also heard from the head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, who spoke about conditions in federal prisons, and he largely denied that solitary confinement was causing mental illness, which I know is a subject of a federal lawsuit, so he was somewhat constrained by what he could say. So I think he was speaking from the side that this wasn't such a significant issue, and then we heard from other activists and experts, from psychologists, who were speaking to the fact that this is such an important prison reform issue.
Rabbi Kontroster, many people might consider solitary confinement a relatively safe and relaxing way to spend one's time in prison. But in recent years, the human rights community has moved to calling it torture, at least under certain circumstances. How did that come about?
It is pretty extreme, but I think there's a growing psychological consensus that it is torture, that it makes people insane. It's mental torture, and the effects are very long-lasting. We're starting to see studies from psychologists who've been speaking for a long time about how these create long-lasting effects. Last year, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, actually issued a report on solitary confinement as a form of torture, and I think that galvanized everyone into beginning to think about this not just as cruel, but as actually a form of torture, that it really does rise to the level of torture.
What do you think might result from the hearing Senator Durbin held?
I think he could introduce federal legislation to study prisons to have an effect specifically on a federal level on the use of solitary confinement in prisons run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. There's hope that the hearing will galvanize statewide efforts to close state supermax prisons. The governor of Illinois just announced that he's going to be closing the Tam supermax prison in Illinois and encourage other states as well, now that they know that the example of states who've reduced their use of solitary confinement, like Mississippi and Maine, are out there, that they'll follow their lead, and that this will become a national trend. But I think there's a lot of work to be done. For 23 hours prior to the hearing, the National Religious Campaign Against Torture held a solidarity fast. We fasted for 23 hours to symbolize the 23 hours a day that prisoners spend alone. And also because there has been prisoner hunger strikes in Virginia and California among prisoners in solitary confinement, because a hunger strike is often one of the only ways that a prisoner has to protest their condition. So clearly a lot more attention has to be paid. People don't know that this is a problem. They don't know that this is out there. They don't understand that many people are released directly from solitary confinement straight into the community. That's part of the federal lawsuit, that there are federal prisoners who are mentally ill, who've been in solitary confinement, who are not being treated for their mental illness because prisoners in federal supermax prisons don't receive psychiatric medication.
That was Rabbi Rachel Kahn Troster with the group Rabbis for Human Rights North America and the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. For more information on challenges to solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Facing extradition from Great Britain to Sweden for questioning related to sexual assault allegations made against him by two women, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange sought political asylum by taking refuge in Ecuador's London embassy on June 19th. Denying the sexual abuse claims, Assange expressed fear that if he were to arrive in Sweden, that nation would in turn extradite him to the U.S. to face charges of publishing classified government and military documents. Many WikiLeaks supporters believe that a grand jury has been impaneled in the U.S. and secretly indicted Assange, awaiting an opportunity to extradite him. Although Assange asserts that the sexual allegations are politically motivated, he says he's prepared to go to Sweden, but only if the Swedish government guarantees that he won't be handed over to the U.S. While Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, considers Assange's application for political asylum, the WikiLeaks founder remains under Ecuador's protection. But British authorities say that if Assange were to leave the embassy building, he'd immediately be arrested for violating the terms of his bail conditions. Your reporter spoke with former FBI special agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley, whose May 2002 memo describes some of the FBI's failures in mishandling of information related to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Here she considers the circumstances surrounding WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's decision to request political asylum from Ecuador.
Julian Assange agreed that he would go to Sweden as long as Sweden promised it would not have him extradited immediately to the United States. And when he made this offer, Sweden came back and said, we can't guarantee that you won't be immediately extradited to the United States. So I really think that it shows that the investigation about sex charges is not valid or not of concern to the Swedish authorities. Otherwise, they would take him up on his offer.
Now, there is information floating around the press that there has been a secret grand jury impaneled in the United States to covertly or in secret level charges at Julian Assange in preparation for any extradition from Sweden, as Julian Assange is concerned about. What evidence do we have that the U.S. Justice Department is seeking charges against Julian Assange?
Well, there was a Stratfor private intelligence contractors document that said he had been secretly indicted many months ago and that he would face these draconian charges. Obviously, most of the whistleblowers under the Obama administration have been charged under the 1917 Espionage Act, which carries the death penalty. So it's pretty clear that that is the case, that he's been investigated. There's other indications as well. His colleagues have been subpoenaed and tracked, and their computers have been seized, etc. So it's pretty clear that he could be facing extradition to the United States. And, of course, it's very reasonable on his part to seek asylum by a country that would, you know, Ecuador might be able to grant asylum to him.
Do you think Julian Assange is doing the right thing by seeking political asylum rather than facing his accusers if he were to be extradited to the United States to actually stand up for what he believes in a court of law? Or does he have really too much at risk to do that?
Well, it's not a question of too much at risk. It's really kind of the question of the times. Our congressional officials and high-level politicians have really, just as they did with Bradley Manning, as even President Obama did with Bradley Manning, who was accused of being a whistleblower, said he's guilty. I mean, he prejudged the case, and he's the commander-in-chief. And many of these officials have called for Assange's assassination. There's also a reluctance to understand that he's a publisher of information, just as the New York Times was back during the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg's giving these Pentagon Papers to 19 papers. And so this inability to understand that freedom of the press requires that publishers have sources and that the sources are protected. What a contrast between Woodward and Bernstein, who protected Deep Throat, their source Deep Throat, all those years, and even were able to uncover wrongdoing by the president, to our situation today where it's considered that the president and congresspersons are above the law and that there is no way to expose wrongdoing on the part of politicians and high-level officials. So I think that Assange is recognizing that here in the United States, after 11 years of war, there is not an ability to coolly and carefully judge the situation as there was back during the Pentagon Papers.
Well, just finally, Colleen, if people are interested in getting involved in one way or another in the WikiLeaks or Julian Assange or Bradley Manning case, how do you think people could best support freedom of speech and government transparency as they look at our government and what they're doing to Bradley Manning and the crosshairs that's now focused on WikiLeaks?
Well, I think for average people, just to call their congressman, and that as a citizen, you want to know the truth about what's going on in the wars and what's going on with the spying and the internal surveillance, etc., and that you don't want this covered up, and that you understand that secrecy actually is what enabled 9/11 to occur. I think if more people would voice that opinion publicly, that it would just naturally, the politicians would reverse what they're doing now, which is going into this top secret America mode. And of course, we could all call the Ecuador ambassador, we can call Obama, we can call the Justice Department, but more people do need to write letters to the editor and actually take action themselves.
That was former FBI special agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley. Find links to more news and analysis about WikiLeaks and founder Julian Assange's bid for political asylum on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.